I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the world. Welcome back to the OMG MotoGP podcast. Alongside myself, Harry Benjamin, this week is, as always, former Grand Prix rider and British champion Keith Ewan. And it's a very special extra episode today as we look ahead to MotoGP being back in action this weekend for the Spanish Grand Prix in Jerez. And we're joined by Matt and Gary from Driven International, the track design specialist. Now, we had Gary and Ben on towards the end of last year, which I know a lot of you loved that episode, the insights into the redevelopment of the Buda International Circuit ahead of the Indian Grand Prix coming back on, to any calendar, not been on there since the Formula One days, back hosting MotoGP. So it's lovely to have you joining us again for this episode. Matt, if we come to you first, so what have you been up to since we last spoke? What's Driven designing this year? What are the big projects you're working on?
Well, there's always lots of stuff happening at Driven. A lot of it, sadly, we can't talk about because of NDAs and
we'll end it there.
Lovely
things, to have you both
on. Yeah, thank you. But there are a few things. We redesigned the final section of Wilton Mill Kart Circuit, which is really exciting, and that hosted the British O-Plate Karting Championships recently. And then in the world of bike racing as well, we have modified the first phase of Circuito de Navarra in Spain. So British Superbikes were racing there this weekend. The first phase is relatively minimal. It was mainly resurfacing and then a modification of one of the corners. But later in the year, there's going to be a much more significant overhaul of the whole middle section. So it's going to be a lot longer, faster, and I think a lot more enjoyable to ride, hopefully. So you can see online on our website about what that's going to look like for the second phase. But yeah, lots of interesting things happening.
Funny you should say, two tracks I know really well. Wilton Mill, which is down the road from me here in Northampton. So Wilton Mill used to be owned by a fellow called Roger Ashby. And Roger Ashby used to do corporate events from there back in the day that he always used to invite us to go to as well. So and it became a car in a venue and went massive. So anybody that's never been to Wilton Mill, I highly recommend it. And then, of course, Navarra, which was the controversial opening round of the British Superbike Championship, as you say, Matt. And I'd never seen the place. I've heard of it, obviously. But I know that a lot of riders weren't looking forward, certainly a lot of teams weren't looking forward to going there because it's a long way. People believe that the British Championship should have started off in Britain, obviously. But Jonathan Palmer and MSVR, mad crazy to get everybody out there to basically give it a test. I wasn't aware that you guys had been involved in it, but you're going to be really pleased to hear this because that fast stuff that you apparently have modified was the best part of the track. It's the bit of the track they all enjoyed. So sigh of relief from our point of view as broadcasters and yours as renovators. It was slightly surprising. You could see it hadn't yet gone through the final phases, because it, if anywhere there was at least Jonathan Palmer MSVR track, I would say it was Navara. The grass wasn't cut. The advertising boards were all at a funny angle. And Jonathan, if he's anything, if you're anything like him, you'll be very picky about what you do.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, that's the thing. Whenever we have one of our projects gets built and then we're having a big significant event for the first time, it's always really interesting just keeping an eye on what all the comments from the riders are saying. You know, obviously you want to make sure it's going to be positive, and thankfully it pretty much always is.
Let me ask you a question on that. I mean, when you're patching a track, it's not ideal, is it? I mean, Donington Park, they did recently, again, MSVR got a long lease on Donington Park now as well, so the same group. But they spent nearly £3 million on completely re-tarmacking the whole track. It's less than ideal when you've got different grip levels, presumably, around parts of the track. What's your kind of recommendation when you've got a hand on that?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And the Donington Park resurfacing was also a project Driven we're involved with as well, actually. So, I mean, I'm not a civil engineer. I'd have to get one of my colleagues to give you the proper technical answer. But yeah, it's definitely something that's recognizable for sure, especially if you're only doing patches of the circuit. Yeah, I think the grip can change quite significantly, but
it's the tests in advance, isn't it, Matt? So when we're when we go to the bitumen plants, it's the aggregate that's made up, it's the bitumen that's used, it's the test that you do in advance on test patches to try and align some of those parameters to try and match things. And likewise, when you're actually planing out the wearing course, which is generally 40 millimeters of any road surface, whether it's a, you know, your normal, M1 or race circuit, you take off the top 40 mil and then you put a new wearing course down. But it is those tests you do in advance to make sure that you match everything up in accordance with what you already have. As we know, historically with Donington, allegedly it was the fuel, but it wasn't a high grip circuit. But now we've, you know, through our development, working with our consultants on the paving, we've managed to, you know, to achieve that. And that happens all around circuits.
Mm. They love Donington Park. And just to underline what you said about fuel, it's the fuel out of the aeroplanes, they were always used to say it was, wasn't it? Exactly. As the aeroplanes flew over, jet fuel apparently pours out. And of course, it's complete rubbish, but it's what used to get the blame.
Yeah.
Oh, it's brilliant to hear the projects you're working on as well. I mean, we want to dive into what's going on with the MotoGP this weekend, of course, going to Jerez. And actually, Keith and I were talking off air. I think we differ, because this been on the calendar for what, 30, well, we've been around for over 35 years, something like that, for Jerez.
1986 was the first MotoGP.
So I would call that, and I don't know if Matt or Gary, you agree, that's a bit of an old school circuit. But Keith, you're thinking actually it's relatively new in this day and age.
Well, it hasn't changed. I mean, it was homologated for Formula One, but you guys have dropped off the end of the calendar with that, because it's not homologated for Formula One in testing or anything nowadays. They never really got a big crowd down there for Formula One. The bikes have always ruled. It's a proper motorbike racing track. I mean, what you got to remember, Andalusia used to be about road tracks originally. It was always sort of road events that were around there. And of course, Formula One drifted uphill a little bit to Catalonia when that came online. In fact, Carmelo Ezpeleta, if I remember rightly, the head man, CEO of Dorna, was part of the original track renovation committee, if I remember, for Catalonia. Now, that is something that's off the back of my head. And you know what it's like for a man of my age, once around that goldfish bowl and... somewhere along the line,
I didn't
remember that Carmelo Ezpeleta was involved in the renovation of Catalonia back in the day.
Wow.
There you go.
Yeah, but I did Jerez not know. Is, you know, a phenomenal track. Used to be the season opener, season opener for testing for Formula One, you know, and they'd be pounding around, you know, the good old days of F1, you know, testing, so everyone had a chance rather than one team. But it was a cracking track for cars. Sadly, you know, accidents happen there, which see things change. But I remember talking to one of the ladies that worked there, one of the circuit managers at the time, and they were saying they used to sell MotoGP out in 3 days.
Wow.
Yeah.
200,000 people would go there.
Yeah.
I mean, you're talking about the best and the worst from Formula One. I mean, the best was the opening round of Formula One, which was Senna and Mansell. If you go, again, know what? Age does have an advantage over you youngsters. You can actually remember some of these really classic events.
I've watched that back a lot, that one.
Senna versus Mansell. There was thousands of a second in it at the end. And, of course, Martin Donnelly, which brought it all to an end in the end when Martin was hurt badly in a massive crash there. But from a bike perspective, it's one of the best tracks on the calendar.
Yeah, the thing that always comes to mind with MotoGP at Jerez is actually, I think it was 1996 or 7, I can't remember exactly, but Alex Crivier and Mick Doohan, final lap, and the crowd were literally pouring over the barriers and just stood in the Ralph area, which, I mean, you could not imagine it these days, but that's the picture that always comes to mind when I think of Jerez and MotoGP.
I'm glad you go back that far, Matt. You've obviously been doing your homework, because 2005 was Rossi and Gibernau, same corner that you're talking about, which is quite funny because Marquez and Lorenzo, same corner, and the same year that they named it Lorenzo Curve Lorenzo when Marquez stuffed him up the slip road.
You've won Keith over straight away there. Well, you're over the hedge now. You're fine.
But I love the driven guys anyway.
But I mean, look, it's an unchanged circuit, isn't it? It is an old school track when it comes to MotoGP land. What is it specifically about the track that you guys admire so much?
I think for me, there's a lot of, you know, really fast corners, which, you know, whenever you watch a motorcycle in particular, just look phenomenal. The whole really long, fast right-hander onto the back straight is amazing. Out of the hairpin as well, you've got the two left-handers. Like, they're really big balls corners. And then you've got the big, heavy braking zone of the final Lorenzo curve, which is great for a last lap decider. I think all tracks should have the big overtaking opportunity as the last corner. You know, you want the battle to go all the way to the line, so that's always really good about Jerez. And it's relatively simple track in terms of there aren't many corners, which I quite like. I like the tracks that have got, you know, maybe 10 to 12 turns rather than sort of 20 plus that you get on some circuits. And I agree with you, Harry. I think it's old school. 1986
for us
but it's how circuits used to be and how they flow. And you see that more in a bike circuit than you do a car circuit. Everything, you know, gradually transition to point and squirt. You know, generally you look at most Grand Prix, Formula One Grand Prix circuits, it's a left or a right more or less 90 degrees, if not tighter. You know, the old days of somewhere like Silverstone, where it was a flowing, quick right-hander being Cobb's corner, you don't see that in Formula One nowadays. But in MotoGP, things are nice and flowing more. You look at Jerez, and the sort of turn four through to turn six reminds me a bit of Catalunya. You know, it's that downhill, sweeping left-hander, back up for another left-hander. You know, so those bits tend to apply to bikes a bit better. It flows a lot more. And that's why I think, you know, some of the older circuits, you know, should be praised a bit more than what some of the modern stuff is nowadays.
Do you find yourself as designers and contractors, obviously, to sort these tracks out, a bit compromised in what you'd like to do because of, obviously, the compromise between a bike track and a car track? I mean, we've been hearing more and more about, now that Liberty are on board, and I know that Harry wants to get to this, I mean, now that Liberty, who own Formula One, now own MotoGP, effectively, there's talk about trying to combine a bike and a car race meeting at weekends at certain venues. I mean, as a track designer, I mean, how does that work?
I think some of it, obviously, you need to look at safety to start with. You know, ignoring the mass of what the circus is for both MotoGP and Formula One, but, you know, the safety element to start with. You know, it's gravel over tarmac, it's air fencing over Tech Pro, it's tires at some circuits. You know, what's the length of your runoff? You know, for a car circuit, how they may bounce over the gravel or asphalt, and the restraint. You know, the safety devices that protects the riders in MotoGP's case, and how that would actually adapt. So I think, you know, I was looking earlier on at, you know, how circuits can differ and where you could host this super event. And one that comes to mind to me straight away, and I remember watching Foggy and Hodgson at Assen and thinking that would be an ultimate circuit, but more likely far, far too quick for an F1 car. And you'd more likely need twice as long straight in runoff space to retard a car, but you wouldn't a bike. So I think there are a number of challenges, and it's more likely the compromise on a corner, a flowing bike corner, would be the element of where it's concerned to actually adapt that runoff to work for bikes more than it would be cars. But then you come into an operational aspect. What could you leave air fencing out for the cars, or do you need to remove that? And how does that work? And what your time frames are in an event? So, I think it's going to be an interesting conundrum and a great conversation to have shortly.
Yeah,
I'm pretty sure. Sorry, Keith. But the other thing I'd say that's a difference in terms of track design between, say, Formula One and MotoGP, I think some corners where in Formula One you would never get overtaking, that's not the case in MotoGP. And a great example of that, I'd say, is Woodcote at Silverstone. That is a nothing corner, so to speak, in a Formula One car. It's just part of the straight. But in MotoGP, that becomes a proper corner. And obviously, there was the great final lap overtake Rins did on Marquez a few years ago. Like, that doesn't happen in Formula One. So as a track designer, it's quite interesting thinking about how a race would actually play out on certain types of corners, and what you would expect for one discipline isn't necessarily the same for another. There's all these tiny little things you've got to think about with the design of things like that.
You do a fair bit of sim testing, don't you? I think with track design and stuff like that. I mean, do you make that comparison at all with bikes and cars, or is that mostly a sim? Obviously, bike sims are massively different from car race sims.
Yeah, so in terms of actual driving simulators, the technology isn't really there to have a realistic sit-on riding simulation. So we do driving mostly. But yeah, we do simulations theoretically for bikes and cars. So yeah, we do cover both of them. But
how close are they? How close are they in actuality? So do you surprise yourself sometimes when the sim expectation suddenly plays out properly in a real world?
Yeah, they are very similar, to be honest. And we've done a lot of work internally on correlating our theoretical simulations with our driver-in-the-loop simulations with actual real-life data to make sure they are absolutely as closely aligned as possible. And yeah, we've really developed that internally recently. But yeah, it is quite accurate for sure. And, you know, that's something we do in our services to clients as well. The visualization side, we actually do come up with full models of these venues, and we can pick out particular viewpoints from grandstands, pit buildings, what the view is going to be. It is not just from a track design and simulation point of view, but also just actually what it's like to be there and experience the venue. Yeah, it's very, very realistic.
I was thinking in my mind there about weather. Do you do that for people sat in the grandstand when it's chucking it down with rain?
Yeah, something to add to the checklist for future, for sure.
Sorry,
as Matt was saying though, Keith, we use that as a, you know, part of the sales tool for the client working. But it also gives, if we build a complete simulation of it, some of the visualizations to start with show what's available to a customer, but the simulation, some of our clients actually want that simulation so they can actually put in a simulator within their garage or their upselling opportunity, because you can actually do young driver training at an early stage on a venue that they go to visit. So where you may go to Silverstone MSV or, you know, a number of the other driving facilities for youngsters, Brooklands, for instance, then although they're driving, you know, learning to drive on the road without getting in a car, you could actually physically drive, I don't know, a GT3 or a Ferrari or something like that around a circuit that we're specifically designing for that client, whether it's in the early stages of the design or actually once it's operational.
Picking up on what Matt said, I mean, and upselling some of this stuff or whatever the phrase should be, it must be brilliant from a SIM point of view that you'd be able to point out where the best places for adverts are and where the best places for... I mean, I remember the amount of time that Stuart Higgs would sit in a television truck, he's series director for BSB, making sure that the signage was in the right place for the cameras. But of course, with a proper SIM, you could do all of that and provide that particular service.
Yeah, absolutely. We did that exactly for when we did the Yas Marina circuit modifications in Abu Dhabi. That whole Turn 9 Marina section was completely overhauled, and there was a massive advertising gantry that they wanted to keep, but we had to relocate. So yeah, we did actually say, look, this is what it's going to look like if you put it in this particular part of the track. So you're absolutely right. Yeah, we can use it for that as well.
We got Gary's pick earlier on with Assen, hoping to see a bit of F1 and MotoGP. There's about five circuits at the moment that do both, right? Matt, which circuit would you want to see host both if you could make it work?
Well, if you could make it work, I love Phillip Island. I think that is an amazing track for the bikes. Obviously, Formula One have never raced there. I'd love to see what they'd be like at that track. I think it'd be pretty spectacular, to be honest.
Yeah. Turn one would be pretty spectacular, that's for sure.
Yeah, definitely. But, you know, Phillip Island is definitely, again, I'd class it as one of the more old school tracks. Maybe you need to do a lot of work to make it up to scratch for F1, I'd say. But yeah, that'd be an amazing one to see both competing at.
But it's never going to happen.
I got a feeling that a Formula One car, if you got loose in Phillip Island, would end up in Tasmania.
Yeah, I think so.
and I love Gary's acid. I could almost see that your tongue sticking so far in your cheek there, Gary.
Of course, there are a couple of tracks that are still on the MotoGP calendar that were on Formula One, and they've dropped off. So
yeah,
Mugello, Portimao, you know, they've disappeared. So there, you know, there are options that do work.
Did you get the feeling that, I mean, that was because of the pandemic, and obviously there was all sorts of a scrabble for people to find tracks that, I mean, I feel that Formula One saved Portimao because it was a track that was teetering on the edge. It wasn't getting the kind of coverage and fans to trackside that it needed to continue properly. And I mean, Formula One descended on it and suddenly found out, oh, bloody hell, a bike track works rather well for Formula One. And it's like Mugello, yeah, they should have known, because it's a Ferrari test track anyway. So,
yeah.
But when they got there, they had a really, really good time. Are there other tracks like that, you think, that MotoGP used that Formula One would enjoy as much, apart from Assen?
Yeah, I think Mugello is a great one. Like you said, when F1 had their one-off race there, I loved it. I thought it was brilliant. Selfishly as well, from a driven point of view, I think Mandalika would be a great one to see F1 go to. Yeah, it's quite a short circuit, I'd say, for Formula One standards, but I think, yeah, it'd be interesting seeing the racing there. Mandalika doesn't have any really long straights either. So yeah, it'd be interesting to see how they go for Formula One. It's definitely a bike circuit, Mandalika, for sure. But yeah, I'd love to see all of them race at each other's circuits. I think it'd be, yeah, fascinating.
Are you guys looking at things like, you know, the Finnish track that never really got off the ground, the Welsh track that never really got off the ground, and those brand new kind of tracks that are sort of, well, mooted but never really get anywhere? Do you get involved in those kind of things? Does it become a driven type thing and then become a massive disappointment when they don't go with the project?
I think it's like a number of, whether it be events, whether it be, you know, concerts or, you know, theatre productions or things like that, you know, we do get approached about a number of projects. There's a surprisingly for what we think that, you know, the planet's populated with motor racing venues, there's still an abundance of people that want to develop their, you know, develop a race or develop a circuit. So yes, there's a lot approaching us. It is a bit of a shame when you do a feasibility study or you get to the stage of we've got that design ready to go across the line, but then something like funding drops away or the desire to take MotoGP to a different country, you know, because we know there's different things that actually are a driver to get a senior championship, you know, to some of these different regions. So yeah, it can be a bit disheartening, but it's something in our locker, you know, ready to enable us to think about the next design, because although it's easy to actually look at other venues around the world and how would that corner fit in? Can you open it out? You know, can you tighten the radius, reduce the radius? What's, you know, how would that take onto another corner? It's always nice to have a number of elements still in the locker ready to roll out to a new venue should it actually fit in that footprint. Because most of the time our designs are constrained by rivers maybe running by the side of it. Whether it's the footprint of the land that you've got, it could be a road, you know, a major road that it runs alongside. Yeah, for instance, Brands Hatch, you know, could that have been extended if the M20 wasn't by the side of it? Or is it the A20 that sits right by the side? You know, there's a number of things that, you know, that do have a compromise. And of course, as we spoke maybe on the last podcast, some of our designs initially have to take into account, so what type of event are you looking to put on? Is it MotoGP? Is it Formula One? Is it, I don't know, just club racing? Because then that dictates garages, garage size, race control, paddock size, you know, how does the park fermé fit? What's the config? You know, how can we fit a configuration in? What's the length of your runoffs that would actually mean that the, you know, the spectators are further back? You know, it's all of those bits that fall into place that sometimes can be a challenge for us. But yeah, we like to keep things in the locker ready to go to the next design.
So what's the next big thing for Driven and how you see it into the future? I mean, the pit lane garages, we've only got single lane garages. Why don't we double stack them or something so we've got an extra lane that goes behind them for Moto3 and Moto2? Heated tracks so we can go to Finland and when it snows we can still race on them. You know, there must be some technology for warmed up tarmac or something. Yeah, communications. I mean, I'm always interested to know who is responsible for putting in the communications at a racetrack. I always believe that the fans should have massive monitors in their grandstands that are connected into the garages so they can see what's going on and that the broadcasters can just plug and play with a. Who puts all that stuff in? Is that part of a Driven brief, or is that something that has to be done retrospectively?
It is part of the brief. So once again, subject to what race series you're looking to have there. MotoGP and Formula One are very, very similar. So you have a, you know, like smart TV setup to be truthful. So it is plug and play when it comes to the feed in and out of race control, into your media center, into your hospitality. But, you know, very valid point, Keith, on when it comes to your fans. You know, obviously there are companies that are developing apps now so you can get up-to-date information straight onto your, you know, your smartphone. Places like Las Vegas done something like that last year and everything was geofenced just with inside the perimeter. But obviously your main hardcore communications are, you know, race control to your marshal's post back, communications into your steward's office. Or as we find, you know, nowadays is obviously track limits, which is where I thought you was going with your comment to start with. But I think, you know, one thing that we need to do is engage the fans more at the venue. Because it's great, you know, we revert back to, you know, what happened during the pandemic and, you know, when races were run behind closed doors and there's no atmosphere. There's nothing better than actually seeing grandstands full of cheering spectators. You know, we spoke about 250,000 people at Jerez, you know, for a race. And, you know, the bike world, especially in Spain, with the fanatical fans, it's great to see. And it adds to the atmosphere.
Are you of the mind that Liberty are going to enhance that? I'm very positive regarding Liberty. I'd be interested to know how you as track designers and and the like would see this new collaboration. Now, the joining up of Formula One and MotoGP, do you see that as a good thing from a track point of view?
I think it could be. I think they certainly have got the, you know, the American, should we say, mentality of customers are key, you know, and communicating to them. We've actually seen through Formula One that they've opened their hospitality packages more. Now, that could be a P&L driver, but to actually do things that get the fans closer, you know, they take key paying clients round the track. They do a lot more hot rides now, or hot laps nowadays.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
They do, you know, truck rides for some of the customers to go around the track to experience what's going on. So I think, they're more likely taking the low-hanging fruit to start with, but then they need to roll that out to the spectators more, you know, to actually turn these fan zones into better experiences. You know, I remember while I was working at Yas Marina Circuit, we started doing the fan days on a Thursday, and people that, you know, that bought a general admission ticket could actually get down the pit lane, could see the cars, you know, can get that bit closer, rather than, as we know historically from the Formula One approach of things, everything was pushed back. I remember the days of when they closed down the paddock, you know, going back my old days, you know, you could walk down the paddock and you could see people like Graham Hill and Emerson Fittipaldi and stuff like that. And you was close to them. You could rub shoulders with them. But then, of course, everything gets locked down. It's a total different model. It's a big commercial model now. But if you can enable spectators to get closer, and I think that's what they've done with Drive to Survive, you know, it's certainly rejuvenated, you know, the interest in car racing, without a doubt.
We mentioned briefly earlier, you know, the projects that you get approached for are still quite a lot. And across motorsport, I suppose, in particular MotoGP, the Middle East, America, are all massive markets. Are you seeing a particular area of the world that there is a high demand for more circuits?
Yeah, definitely. You know, for Driven, 90% of our business is international. We do still work in the UK, but it's mainly over the world, and in particular North America, India, Middle East. I'd say those are the three that we work mostly in. Which is really exciting, particularly in India, where, you know, Bud was really the first track that came along. There's a few other little club circuits, but there's been a real demand recently for more and more circuits. We did the Formula E circuit in Hyderabad recently. We've got a few other projects going on at the moment in India, like club circuits that are up and coming, sort of grade two, sort of grade B level. But Middle East, India, North America. And in North America, it's more club circuits. Those are the real, because they've got a lot of racetracks already that they use for racing, but it's the sort of country club private style, which is what's really popular over there.
Okay.
Where does the funding come from? I mean, are these things, you know, localized? You can imagine local authorities and the like competing with each other to kind of get a Grand Prix. I was thinking that we lost Argentina this year, Termas de Rio Hondo, up in the north as Argentina. You know, MotoGP great. I mean, an interesting racetrack, difficult but interesting, but in a region that isn't very wealthy, and it's fallen off the edge of the cliff. I mean, you know, having done work, I don't think you had anything to do with that particular one, but I mean, it's one of those ones that has just fallen by the wayside. I mean, does that affect driven in any way when you've got a project up and running and all of a sudden they're not using the track? I mean, these are like your babies. I know we've spoken off air before. You know, each and every track that you work on is like it gets a big cuddle before it's allowed to have anything on it.
Yeah, I think that's the thing. Whenever we're doing the planning for a circuit as well as the design, we'll also do feasibility planning. And it is so important that you make sure that the numbers do add up and you can actually run these venues as 365-day places. You know, a lot of circuits, they'll have the big events because that's what gives them the publicity and gets their name out as a venue. But then it's all of the other events across the weekdays that, you know, is the real money makers, really. There's lots of different things to think about. Like Gary said earlier, there might be issues with particular parcels of land or adjacent areas around it, local governments and councils, funding. Yeah, so many different parts of the pie when you're designing these venues. So yeah, always loads of things to think about.
I think, Keith, it goes back to it's the aspiration. It's what's the target that the client actually wants to achieve. So in a situation like some of the private members clubs, they'll look for stakeholders that are, you know, looking to sell real estate or something like that. You know, these private clubs, someone may come up with the idea of the track, we'll come up with the design, but then they'll put condos around the outside, and that's what generates, you know, at least the funding to start with, to get them off the ground, get them up and running, and then they can take a view thereafter. And obviously so many days are sold as part of that package. A member will get so many days on track and they can buy extra. When it comes to a race circuit, it depends on, you know, what they're looking to do. So really nowadays, anything to do with MotoGP or Formula One, you certainly need some form of government backing or some massively wealthy investors. You know, they've got a long portfolio of what they want to introduce and how they can offset that against their capital expenditure. Because we're not talking, you know, small change. You know, even when it comes to resurfacing a circuit, as we said with MSV of Donington, you know, we are talking big money. And we find in the UK that a slightly different approach is actually, you know, places like Silverstone and Donington and Brands have had big key events in the past, and generally to an operator, that's a cost to them. So then they have to try and recuperate their expenditure through every other event, whether it be a car or bike track day during the week, whether it be someone, I don't know, for argument's sake, launching a new forklift that you rent out the back paddock, or you'd have some form of trade show there to actually generate income. So it's not necessarily always about the racetrack itself, the asphalt that you're using, but the more a client can use every bit of that facility, whether it's a hospitality, whether it's a track, whether it's a drift area out the back, whether it's a rally handling stage, every bit you can monetize to try and keep that P&L tight. That's what we need to look at with our designs.
It's always
and
so...
it shows
Go
when
on,
you
Keith.
Turn up at a racetrack. Sorry, Harry. When you turn up at a racetrack, you can usually see what the investment's going like. I was at Silverstone this morning for a coffee, and I can see they've put new trees in.
Well, they've got the hotel and those little rooms that look right over the circuit now, don't they?
It's the little details here and there. I mean, I think they're big details in as much as that they can afford the trees and the odds and sods like that, because they're putting in living units and so on and so forth. I mean, this is all a bit not very motorcycle, I must say. I've got to say that's the other thing. We get this complete...
he says with a fake tree behind him.
Yeah, you like my fake tree. I was thinking of getting my head under there so it looked like I've got more hair, but no, it doesn't work. But it is a situation where these kind of things that we're talking about at the moment, infrastructure wise, condos and so on and so forth, are almost the opposite to what motorcycle fans generally feel at home with, and the costs involved in that as well. So we've got almost completely opposing demographics with bikes and cars, which is why it seems at the moment, this is why I'm so excited about Liberty, because I think they will try and bring that together. I personally can't see MotoGP and Formula One on the same weekend or the same racetrack. I mean, we all want a different line on the track. There's different tire deg and so on and so forth. There'll be bits and pieces all over the bloody road that the bikes don't want, and the cars will be moaning about our deg on their lines and so on and so forth. You'll just have double the whinging that you would normally get at a racetrack.
Yeah.
So I kind of can't, from a spectator point of view, it might be interesting for a demo or something along those lines. I think we might see a bit more demonstrations perhaps between Formula One at motorbike meetings and motorbike demos. We had Doohan, didn't we, riding around on a 500 the other day, Mick Doohan.
With his son in the cars. Yeah, that was cool. And more of that is what you need, because if it could give more eyeballs to MotoGP, I think if more F1, because we've always said this, you're either a bike guy or you're not, really, from the get-go. But I think there's a lot of four-wheel fans who generally just haven't seen MotoGP, not out of choice of choosing not to see it, just it hasn't popped up on their radar for some reason, because you just get engrossed in Formula One, and if you are into four wheels, then you find all the sports cars and the like, etc. But I think if most F1 fans watched a MotoGP race, I'm pretty sure they'd be hooked straight away with the way the racing is, because there actually is a fight for the lead at the moment.
I know, shocking.
Well, do you know what I'd actually do if I was Silverstone, seeing Silverstone are struggling as much as they are with MotoGP, and I hate it, pains me to say it, 45,000 people last year on the Sunday at MotoGP at Silverstone, on what is a difficult racetrack from a spectator point of view, for some of the reasons you've mentioned, Gary, earlier on, you know, and the design of a track. When you've got fast corners, it means people have got to be pushed back out of the way so that we've got the runoffs that we need for bikes and so on. But I believe that Silverstone should give, with every Formula One ticket, they should give a MotoGP ticket.
Not a bad idea.
You know, if Liberty are on board and they want to progress MotoGP in the UK, then there's certainly a margin for giving away a little bit of MotoGP to your Formula One fans.
I bumped into somebody, I didn't know them, on the train the other day going into London, and I got recognised, actually. And she was going, I ended up talking to her, she's going to the Formula One Silverstone British Grand Prix this weekend. And she's this year. And she'd never been before, but she could only, A, afford to go to Friday, the practice day. She was desperate to do the whole weekend, but she just couldn't. And she'd never been to a track before. She was just so excited to go. And that idea would be so perfect for somebody like that, because, you know, okay, only the Friday for a Formula One, but you can get a weekend ticket to go and see the MotoGP. I know it's not the out-and-out solution, but it's a nice incentivizer. It's a nice way to get more people with eyes on the bikes, isn't it?
There actually had to be a reason why she wanted to talk to you. Now
nobody talks to me otherwise.
It's free tickets.
I thought it was transport police coming my way, but it wasn't, thankfully. Look, we've come to the end, really. But Matt and Gary, it's always such a pleasure to get the insights of what Driven International do. It's always so fascinating. We can't let you leave because it is Jerez this weekend. And this is our preview show. Amy is coming up in a bit to chat with Keith all about the latest news coming into the weekend. And we do predictions every time. So Matt and Gary, I need your sprint winner and your Grand Prix winner, please. Now, I know I've sprung that on you. I do realise I didn't give you the heads up on that.
That's all right.
But who's ready? Who wants to go first?
Go on. I'll go first. So I reckon sprint race... I was gutted for Vinales at Cota last week, the other week. Really gutted about that. I reckon Jorge Martin is going to win the sprint race. And I'm going for Pedro. For the last win this weekend. The bike craft that guy has got was just, I couldn't believe it.
Especially around Jerez.
It's going to be incredible. Just the way he was, you know, backing the bike in, it sort of snapped from, if it was a car, it would be oversteer, understeer. It just was moving around all through the corner. Just amazing. Can't wait to see it.
Go on, Matt. What have you got?
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm going to go Bastianini for the sprint. He's been on a good roll this year. Like, I think he'll get a sprint. But then I was going to agree with Gary. I think Acosta, you know, he got third in Portugal, second at COTA.
The home first. Crowd powering him on.
Home crowd for his first MotoGP win.
Yeah. Why not?
You're locked in now. And
how about you guys?
Oh, well, Keith, go. Do you want to save it before you do it with Amy or at the end of the show, or do you want to do it now?
Yeah, I think that I'm going to give Amy first shout, I think, on this. But I mean, I love the Pedro Acosta. For me, again, I'm actually with you guys on that one for sure. I think Pedro Acosta. My Pedro Acosta merchandise actually arrived this morning. I have some Pedro Acosta merchandise.
Well, I don't want to know what kind of merchandise you got from him after hearing his comments.
And I've got some Maverick Vinales merchandise as well, Matt. So you'll be pleased to hear that, but Gary as well. Yeah. It's funny that that kind of stuff. Yeah, I'm always buying it. I don't know why I buy this stuff. I never get it free either. So I've got lots of merch, and my kids all think, "What the bloody hell's he wearing? Who's Acosta?"
That's a true fan right there. Look, stay tuned because this is not the end of the show. Amy's going to be here with Keith, chatting through all the latest runners and riders, quite literally ahead of the Spanish Grand Prix. I won't be here, but I'm going to do my prediction now. I better do that. Sprint. You know what? I haven't seen much from Aleix Espargaró recently, so I'm going to go Espargaró. Sprint win and Pedro Acosta Grand Prix win. I was going to go for Jorge Martí, but no, we'll go for Acosta. Look, Matt, Gary, thank you so much for taking the time. Do check out the Driven International's work online and on their social media as well. We'll have all the links in the description below, wherever you're listening or watching this podcast and across our socials as well. But for the time being, Matt and Gary from Driven International, thank you so much.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks, Harry. And of course, a big thank you to Matt and Gary. Keith, we've had some really cool guests so far in 2024.
Yeah, Driven guys. Do you know what? That could be a 2-hour long episode, couldn't it? And we could get involved in that because, I mean, the building of racetracks, you know, it's a very complex situation. And you just don't realise how much has to go into it. Obviously, it's complex. Obviously, there's a lot of thinking needs going. But it evolves, doesn't it? As these motorbikes get quicker and quicker and quicker, everything evolves. And then, you know, I only seen Dubai, who don't build drainage systems really well just lately, and the whole place is 5 foot deep in water because it's usually in the desert. So you've kind of got this infrastructure you've got to really make work for the country you're in based on the information you've got. And sometimes even that doesn't work out so well. But Driven, they're a good bunch of guys and they're really good fun to talk to.
Okay, so this weekend it's the Spanish Grand Prix. And I think personally for me, Keith, this was actually one of my favourite races from last year. I felt like the atmosphere from the crowd was almost palpable through the TV screens. And the reception that Dani Pedrosa got was incredible.
Well, yeah, I mean, he ended up finishing 7th place, but that kind of doesn't do the full justice, does it, really, when you look at how hectic it was last year. I mean, the amount of crashes alone just about did it as well. But really, really tight racing. I mean, at the end, Bagnaia taking it from Binder and Miller. Never had a KTM gas, of course, because we got the Acosta fact that we'll talk in a moment. But Aprilia Aprilia and KTM and gas have never won a race here at Jerez yet. And I've got a feeling this weekend is going to be their weekend. It's a track that Acosta knows really, really well. He's got, according to Nick Harris, the wonderful Nick Harris, who you've worked with many, many, many times, Amy, he put a piece out this morning. Acosta's got 7 races still to break the youngest ever Grand Prix winner in MotoGP. 19 years and 339 days if he wins this weekend. Marc Márquez did it in 20 years and 63 days. So Acosta is on for making history. It's a track he knows well. It's a track he's won at before, Moto3. He got his ass kicked last year, though, by Sam Lowes in Moto2. Good old Sam. So Acosta, the superstar, got well beaten by Sam Lowes last time out. In Moto2. But I just feel this weekend, the KTM works around there, the gas. Do you know what? We don't really go on about that much. Gas is an independent team through Tech 3. It's amazing. An independent team with a brand new rookie on it that's been on the podium twice in the last I mean, he'll be the youngest kid. We keep doing these records, don't we? He'll be the, if he finishes on the podium again this weekend, he'll be the youngest ever to have done three podiums in a row. These things are reeling off. I feel like we've been, it's a bit deja vu, isn't it? With Marc Márquez, we used to be saying these things every weekend. And now we're doing it with Acosta.
Obviously, though, it's, I mean, you've mentioned one of them. It's home turf for a lot of the big hitters. He's going to have to really get his elbows out because there's going to be a lot of people that are wanting to assert themselves. And not even just the home heroes. Pekka Bagnaia, obviously winner of the last 2023 Jerez race. You kind of would assume that he would want to reassert himself.
But it's a track he can make mistakes on. Bagnaia has made mistakes here when he's been leading in the past. I remember that. So it's a situation where they all have data for Jerez. They've all tested in Jerez. They know the track really, really well. It's consistent in what it gives you. I think it's going to be a proper bun fight this weekend. It's going to be about, you know, the sprint race is a bit of a negative for me here because I think that you could end up with some damage done on Saturday, which could affect Sunday's racing, which we all hope doesn't happen. But it's a very... And it's got that wonderful last corner, you know, Lorenzo, Curve Lorenzo. I love it because they named it Curve Lorenzo after Marc Márquez stuck it up the inside of Lorenzo and had him over going back, I think, Brittany down somewhere. 2013 was when they named it Curve Lorenzo, which just happened to coincide with the same year that Marc Márquez stuffed him on the final corner. I mean, it is a corner and a half. You've come through three massively fast right-handers, flat out on a Moto3, just about flat out on a Moto2, but definitely gets your attention on a MotoGP bike through those final three right-handers. And then you've got into the braking area of that hairpin left-hander before you get home under the spaceship. It's a bit special. It's funny that you say this is one of your favourites. I find myself saying that about every single racetrack. The only one I don't is the one that's the most supported, which is Le Mans. It's the only one that to be honest, it doesn't do much for me, Le Mans, but from a popular point of view, it is massively popular and well-supported. The promoters do a great job at the French Grand Prix. But every Grand Prix I find saying, oh, Mugello, it's a huge bucket list. Oh, Jerez is bucket list. Every one of them is, really.
Well, Jerez isn't my favourite race. I just remember Jerez being like one of my favourite races from last year for some reason. But on that subject, obviously, we've got a fair few Spanish races. Which one would be your best Spanish race? Because I think actually maybe it would be my best Spanish race, mainly for the action that we get.
This is the trouble I have a little bit. I mean, everyone goes on about it being such a pro-Spanish Grand Prix series, which is a shame, really, because I love Aragon. I really like Aragon. Catalonia is just outside Barcelona. It's next to the capital. It's great. You've got Jerez down in Andalusia, which is a wonderful region anyway, and it's a great racetrack. Then the history of Jerez, it don't go back that far, actually. It's, you know, it used to be street circuits. I think we were talking with the Driven guys about it earlier on. It's one of those situations where there's been some fantastic races there, but I think the Spanish have such great racetracks. And then we're bolted onto Portugal next door and we got Portimão. So if you're in that Iberia region, you are spoiled for choice. And of course, such a lot of talent is coming from that region as well.
Well, talking about the talent, Jorge Martin leads the championship coming into this one, but you and I were talking about this last time out. He was a bit scrappy last time in Austin. He perhaps needs a bit more of a smoother weekend.
He'll have straightened his head out this weekend. I think what happens is he's the kind of guy that, I think once the adrenaline is flowing, the amount it was last time out, he couldn't stop himself from trying to force everything to fit. Once that flow gets lost on these bikes, you know, you're thousands of a second off the pace and you're trying to, you know, force it to fit. I don't expect that this weekend. I think, well, you haven't said that. The tension's building, isn't it? You know, it's a long season and he's keen to get the job done. You know, this is where the likes of Bagnaia come into his own. You know, Bagnaia, you know, he kind of sneaks up on you. He's not a Marc Márquez. He's not, you know, some of these guys, he's not a Jorge Martin where, you know, it's all elbows and front end slides. You know, Bagnaia builds on the season, builds on his performance. And we could be seeing that again. I mean, you know, why is it we don't really talk about Bagnaia that much? But he could win again this weekend with some ease. We'll wait and see. Have I put my money on anybody yet? I don't think I have, you know. I think I've cheated. I think you lot have all put your bets in, but I haven't actually done that yet.
Do you want to give me your predictions for this weekend?
Help into it. Right, I'm going to go for Acosta I'm going to go for the Grand Prix on Sunday. Pedro Acosta as a winner. I mean, his first ever win. I think that he's got performance there. He knows the track well. He's there or thereabouts. So definitely, you know, he's gonna be in it somewhere. Jack Miller. I wonder if Jack Miller can build on what he was doing in COTA. Hopefully he will do. I'm going to have Jack Miller as a third place man, and I'm going to put Bagnaia in the middle. So the main race is Acosta, Bagnaia, Miller. Saturday, I'm going to have Jorge Martin. I really tend to... I didn't put bloody Mark Marquez in there, did I, either? And it's been... Do you know what? I looked at the sheet. 917 days it will be on Sunday since he's won a race.
Wow.
917 days. That is unbelievable since Mark Marquez won in 2021.
Did you ever think we'd be saying that?
Well, with his injury, I didn't think he was going to be actually fit enough to come back, to be honest. I thought that injury, you know, with what he's had to do, that kind of surgery, where you've had to break the arm again and give it a twist to put it all in line. I mean, that's fairly horrendous.
Right.
So the fact that the guy's riding and he's hit, you know, he's up the sharp end is remarkable. And he's on an independent bike. And last year's independent bike at that. So I think the guy... So let me have Mark Marquez so I'm going to go for Jorge Martin, Mark Marquez and Pecco Bagnaia on the sprint race on Saturday.
Keith, just before we finish up, I just wanted to ask you about perhaps one of the side stories that's been spoken about at the moment. And there's a lot of talk about which manufacturer some of the satellite teams will go with. Pramac VR46 and LCR even. And we know like LCR Licio's been with Honda for, gosh, almost 2 decades. Can you see any of those three deviating away from their existing manufacturer? And obviously Yamaha are super keen to have a satellite team. Can you see them getting an extra 2 bikes on the grid next year?
It's all happening at Yamaha at the moment, and I think that they've actually nailed their colours to the mast, which is brilliant. I mean, Lynn Jarvis is rolling over. It's a question mark that I think has been over. You know, I think that he's overseen some great times at Yamaha, but it struck me as it was time to move. You know, we saw Livio Supo move from you know Honda back in the day. There's something, you know, Jeremy Burgess got fired I know he wasn't factory, he was crew chief, but at the end of the day, some of these famous names and big names in our sport get rolled over from time to time. And I think Lynn Jarvis being moved really is a big thing for Yamaha. Yamaha committed themselves a huge money for Quartararo to keep him on the M1 is really important. So I think the likes of Yamaha are going to be key. They need a satellite team. You need that data. You cannot can't have 2 bikes on the grid and expect to do the business. You know, Suzuki were, you know, pushing it uphill to do the same thing. I think that definitely if you're serious, you need, you know, Yamaha need a satellite team. How that shapes out is going to be down to funding and weather as well. With Liberty, again, I think Dorna have been a bit restrictive when they didn't allow more bikes on the grid. You know, when KTM was clearly keen to have a couple of more bikes on the grid. You know, you've got Ducati with 8 and Yamaha with only 2. Well, that ain't right. That needs sorting. So extend the grid. I mean, it's going to cost more money. I wonder how that breaks down from Liberty's point of view. But is Liberty prepared to find the funding for that and make sure that the changes that are made are well funded? Then maybe that's a position and it can be made to work. But you know, we're not talking about a little amount of money here. It's quite a large amount of money to put another couple of bikes on the grid. You know, you've got to extend your tire contracts. You've got to extend all sorts of stuff to make that work. But it will be a good thing for the sport. And I think Liberty will recognize that really, really soon. And certainly Yamaha are the team that need to jump on that. And moving, if I may, back to the BMW. You know, we love the BMW rumor, don't we? There's always a Kawasaki or BMW rumor. Kawasaki are well out of it. But the BMW rumor, now that they've started winning in World Superbikes, thanks to Toprak, Mazgov, Yogdu, you can imagine that they might well muddy the water slightly. I mean, the time for a new manufacturer to arrive at the scene will be at the changes of the rules, which are in 2027, because you've got time to get engineering in place with whatever the new proposals are for the 850cc bikes that we're going to have from 2027. That will be the ideal time when no one else really has an advantage over a new manufacturer because everyone's starting with a fresh book of data. So you don't know whether BMW, you know, it might be that Liberty will hold on from those 2 extra spaces and BMW will come in with a new team. Or, you know, like I said, with the driven guys, that you know, Valentino Rossi, who's just finished off the back of second place in the Imola 6-hour race that's just been gone on. He's won at Misano in his GT3. He's got a BMW connection, quite a tight one there now. Well, there's no one more famous than Valentino Rossi and the global reach that Valentino Rossi's team has, the VR46 team has. So you would think that somewhere there's a bit of a deal to be done. You know, it's quite exciting. I mean, I think 2027 is going to be an exciting year. We've only got a couple of years to go before we get to that.
Always good to get your thoughts, Keith. Okay, we are out of time. Before we go, we're going to close off by sending out a massive thank you to our current Patreon supporters, Anne Height, Scott Casey, Josh Miller, Peter Smith, Josh, Eric Fajardo, Sam Smith, Rob Connick, and Mel. And of course, if you want to become one of our Patreon members, you can benefit from early access to podcasts and get first dibs on our listener questions. But that's it from us for now. We'll be back on Monday.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.